Okay, on to our next story. And more Britons are facing questions over links to the Utøya killer, Anders Breivik. This is the Norway killer story. The names have emerged from interviews with Breivik and English anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray, say the Norwegian police. This is in The Guardian. The Norwegian police are saying they are to question several British citizens in their search for the potential accomplices of the mass killer Anders Breivik. And officers in Oslo said the names of individuals in several far-right groups emerged from questioning of British anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray, as well as further interviews with Breivik. Apparently, Breivik wrote that he attended the founding meeting of the Knights Templar European Military Order in London in 2002, where he met a mentor who used the pseudonym Richard after Richard the Lionheart. He signed the 1,500-page document with an anglicised version of his name and datelined it London 2011. Breivik also repeatedly praised the English Defence League, saying he had 600 EDL supporters as Facebook friends and had spoken with members and leaders. The EDL has condemned the killings and has denied any official contact with Breivik, insisting it is a peaceful, non-racist organisation opposed to extremism. Now, Steve, you on this first. Are you worried that the Norwegian police are over here going around interviewing far-right in Britain?
No, I'm actually quite encouraged by it. I mean, if they found that there is a link with this killer, then, you know, I think we ought to cooperate.
Because originally we were told he was just doing this on his own and there was no connection, but it's clearly come out in the last couple of weeks through what the Norwegian police have been saying, that there were connections here in Britain.
Yeah, there were, by the sound of it. And, you know, I think we do need to get to the bottom of those. I mean, there is across Europe, there are a group of these fanatical people who have this worldview that they're on some sort of crusade to preserve Christianity against against the caliphate and all the rest of it. And I think we do need to expose these. You have, you know, they're similar to what we had with Timothy McVeigh in America 15 years ago. And we do need to get to the bottom of this, and we do need to ensure that if there are links, then people are exposed, clearly.
Martin, this anti-Muslim blogger Paul Ray apparently was interviewed last week after claims he may have been the mentor mentioned by Breivik in his manifesto posted online shortly before he carried out the killings on the 22nd of July.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when an incident like this happens, the first thing that crosses... I mean, obviously, one's horrified. It was clearly a political incident. Most of the people killed were young Labour Party activists on their summer camp, so there's a very definite political dimension to this. I mean, Norway is a very well-managed country, in my view. The Labour Party have run it very successfully the last 50 years. Their economy is in better shape than ours, although we're all in the same mess. But at the same time, these people are really dangerous, and there's got to be a question of what the linkages are. The far right in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, they bombed Bologna railway station, they killed 80-odd people. They were being orchestrated by the Western intelligence services, by NATO intelligence. It's all in Daniel Ganser's book. He's an academic from Switzerland, NATO secret armies. Now, the first thing that crosses my mind with an incident like this, is there more to it than just an individual? Is there a network of far-right extremists? And behind that, are the intelligence services implicated? I'm not saying they are, but it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. The Brabant massacres in the 1980s in Belgium, again, a Belgian parliamentary inquiry uncovered that their own security services, including the British security services, were involved. Now, this is all part of the Gladio network. The assassination of Olaf Palme in Sweden was also
so
a potential...
Was he? Come on,
he was the Prime Minister of Sweden, and he was assassinated, and the suspicion that again was NATO intelligence because they didn't like Palme's international politics. Now, I'm not saying that this is definitely what's happening here, but that's one of the questions that arises in my mind, and I hope the Norwegian police will follow the trail wherever it leads and arrest whoever they need to arrest.
I mean, the difficulty with the Gladio networks, I mean, they were also known as Gladio was the Italian version, they were known as stay behind networks.
Yeah.
The idea was that if communism took over liberal democracies, and a group of people would form a terrorist war behind them. Now, the difficulty is, once you sort of arm people and train them, you're never too sure where they're going to go with that after the event. And certainly, there's implications behind the Bologna train bombing in 1980. There was definite links between Fiore, who did that, who spent some time over in the UK, and he had links with the British far right. Equally in Turkey is quite interesting now, because you've got the Ergenekon trials with the army and implications. So yeah, I mean, this does go deeply, and we, you know, it may come out that someone's got an each way bet on some of these organisations. But certainly, you know, as we've seen, the terrible attack on civilians. I mean, one thing about Norway, just as a bit of an aside, but I think it's interesting given that Martin is an economist. I mean, one thing I do admire the Norwegians for is that whether they've had Labour governments or right of centre governments, with North Sea Oil, they've established a principle that this is an investment fund for future generations of the country, and they very much did that as a separate entity. And I was talking to somebody from Denmark a couple of days ago. Denmark didn't do it, neither did the UK. Mm-hmm. And Norway's quite unique in that they did actually look at this as an investment for the future. Dubai has to some extent as well, but they've gone down the consumerist road. And I think long term, actually, Norway's probably going to be a success.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Norwegian approach to North Sea oil is, A, they had a state-run oil industry, which took them longer to get off the ground because they didn't know anything about it, so they had to train themselves up. But, of course, because they had political stability, there was no rush to get oil on stream quickly to make a political... I mean, basically, the Labour Party decided to bring in the American oil majors because they wanted to bring it on stream quickly to bribe the electorate in 1979. And of course, in Norway, that's not an issue because there's a stable setup, and people just think, "Well, how we've got this oil there? We're only going to take it out once, so let's take our time." The other thing about their sovereign wealth fund is they're not allowed to invest inside Norway because in that way you avoid what's called the Dutch disease, where your currency appreciates because you become an oil currency. And what happens then is you get a lot of money from the oil, but your manufacturing industry is priced out of international markets. So the sovereign wealth fund in Norway cannot invest inside Norway, it has to invest abroad. So in this way, it protects the currency from being overvalued. Now, this is all very smart stuff. And when I look at the mismanagement of the British economy over the last 30 years, it makes me want to tear my hair out in despair, if I had any. And you can't see that I haven't out there in Radio Land, but I know.
Now, also, this week on the Today programme, John Humphreys, a presenter there, pinned down a guy called Tommy Robinson, who's one of the leaders and founders of the English Defence League here in Britain, as part of their 10th anniversary of the September 11th attack. So let's have a listen to that.
Set up and run by a Luton businessman, Tommy Robinson, the EDL has been remarkably successful in a very short time at getting people around the country to come out onto the streets to protest against what they see as a growing threat from Islam.
30 years ago in this town, there was 3,000 Muslims and one mosque. If you'd have said to people 30 years ago, in 30 years' time, there'll be 19 mosques, there'll be 30, 40, 50,000 Muslims, they'll be banning the Emblem of St George in your school, they'll be opening a prayer centre in the Arndal Centre, they'll be attacking your troops when they're walking home, they'll have stalls set up promoting jihad and extremism every single week in the town. 30 years ago, people would have said, never, that's not going to happen in Luton. Well, it's happened. At the end of the day, Islamic demographics are terrifying. The birth rate and the statistics are terrifying.
So are you just racists?
I'm not racist at all. I completely hate racism. We've defeated Nazism, but yet we're allowing Islamism to flourish because it goes under a banner of religion.
But aren't you promoting hatred against them?
We don't do anything out of hate, we do it out of love. Love for Christianity, love for our culture, love for my kids' futures.
At the heart of this conflict is obviously fear. But is it fear of Islamic terrorism, another 9/11, or is it something else? Robinson says what his organisation fears is Sharia law.
Now, in 2003, the European Court of Human Rights outlawed Sharia law in Europe and said it's incompatible with Western democracy due to their views on homosexuals, their views on women, and their views on infidels. That's all of us. It's incompatible. Won't work. And all we're seeing now is a louder voice and a louder call for Sharia law and aspects of Sharia law to be implemented into the British legal system.
Social fabrics of this society, even the economic, political, are collapsing. And this is where people like myself come along and we present this alternative, which I believe is Islam.
That's exactly what the English Defence League fears, or maybe we should call it the Englishness Defence League.
That was John Humphreys on the Today programme earlier this week. Now, first of all, Steve, you on this. I mean, what they're doing, he's doing there, and I was quite surprised that Humphreys didn't question him on when he was saying that, oh, well, we love them and we're Christians. What do you think of what are the English Defence League and how is it, do you think, that they can get away with saying, oh, well, we are just Christians, whereas it seems that they're more like these kind of Knights Templar Crusaders rather than actually embracing the teachings of Christ?
Yes, I think you should have asked him which church he attended and when he last went, actually. That might have been interesting, because I very much doubt if the answer would have been the previous Sunday. I think there is an issue with alternative laws, and I'm hoping at my party conference towards the end of the month there's a fringe meeting by a campaign group called One Law for All. I mean, I am a secularist. I don't believe that religion should play any part in the state, and that we should have one law for all, which is the secular law. Having said that, there are occasions where internal disputes between individuals can be settled by other means, and we've had examples that have run successfully. There's a Jewish court to do with food measures, I think the Beth Din or something, and that seems to work. There is the halal rules on slaughter, and it's made clear that, you know, this is halal meat as opposed to non-halal, and I don't have too much of a problem with that. You know what you're getting, you can make your individual choice. But I do think a lot of it does appear to be cultural racism. I don't think it's Islam as a religion that they don't like. I think it's the people who practice the Islamic religion who predominantly are of brown complexion, and I think that appears to be the motivation for this. I hadn't even heard of the EDL until about 3 or 4 years ago. I was at a football match in Cardiff and saw somebody with English Defence League on his t-shirt. Didn't know what it was, looked it up on Google, and it's clear I think it's designed to bring into right-wing activity people who are not necessarily political, but, you know, have some unease about what's happening. And it, obviously there are links with people like the BNP, but it's seen as it pervades this apolitical image, where clearly it isn't. It's part of the far right.
Martin, do you think this English Defence League of Steve saying there is relatively recent? It's got echoes of other groups which have disbanded from years gone by?
Well, yes. I mean, if you think when the English Defence League started in Luton, if you remember, the incident began with the Royal Anglian Regiment marching through Luton, getting the freedom of the city, and a small number of jihadists held up signs saying, you know, go to hell, British soldiers, we want you killed, blah, blah, blah. And then the English Defence League that were then formed in response to that. Now, what I suspect or fear is that both the English Defence League and groups like Al-Majahroon are glove puppets for the creation of social chaos. We saw this in Italy, we were talking about Gladio earlier, we saw this in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, and as Philip Whitehead, I think, was the journalist, he said, well, the right-wing terrorists were glove puppets and the left-wing terrorists were marionettes. But both sets of terrorists, the Red Brigades and the fascists, Nuclei Marti Proletari, Prima Linea, they were all being manipulated by the intelligence services to create chaos. And in Turkey, that was exactly the same process. So you had right-wing and left-wing terrorists tearing the place apart, and then the army takes over in 1980 in Turkey and says, oh, we've put a stop to all of that. Well, that's easy to do because they were organising it all, and that's what's being uncovered in these trials. Now, have we got, I just put it as a question, have we got in Britain Al-Majahroon and the EDL are our version of this game? Strategy of tension. And Al-Majahroon, of course, and all these other groups, these extremist Muslim groups, which are not in any way representative of the Muslim community at large. Melanie Phillips, the journalist in the Daily Mail, has written a book called Londonistan, and she waxes indignant about the number of jihadis in London. Well, there's a simple reason for that, Melanie. It's because MI6 was the lead agency in Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, where we smashed the Russians out of Afghanistan by using an Islamic International Brigade, now known as Al-Qaeda. And who set that up? MI6. And that's why Al-Majahroon and all these, Captain Hook and all the rest of them, are in London, because they were invited here by our own intelligence services.
See, I wonder whether there's an element of badge engineering about this. A few years ago, there was an organisation called Combat 18,
yep,
that used to door bomb walls.
HH. 18 that's is right. 1H. Heil Hitler, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, because AH was the first and eighth letter of the alphabet. And they appeared for a while. Now, there were allegations, and, you know, this caused a lot of hand-wringing, as did the EDL. Now, there were allegations that Combat 18 was actually a honey trap that was set up by the security services in order to attract the sorts of people that would engage in right-wing terrorism and so on, to identify them so that the security services knew where they are. So, for instance, David Copeland, the nail bomber, was picked up. Now, appear to have been picked up comparatively easily, and you wonder whether, you know, that was because he was C-18 or some similar organisation, and the state knew his name and address.
Yeah,
What's the purpose of this kind of activity then, Martin?
Well, in Italy in the 70s, they called it the Anni di Piombo, the Years of Lead, or the Strategia di Tensione, Strategy of Tension. Basically, the Communist Party in Italy, the PCI, was very strong, and they set fair to win several elections in post-war Italy. But every time they came near to winning an election, suddenly all of this terrorism would break out. And Bologna, of course, was bombed because it was a communist voting city. Most of those people who died were communist voters because it was in Bologna. And in Turkey, it was basically the army. And don't forget that Turkey is well integrated into NATO. Turkish military officers are trained at Sandhurst. They are part of NATO. So the Turkish army was involved in fomenting both right and left-wing terrorism in the country in order to seize power and prevent various social reforms from being carried through and so forth. Now, this, in fact, is standard NATO modus operandi. It's not something that we... this isn't conspiracy theory. This is all historically documented fact. Parliamentary inquiries in Belgium, Switzerland and Italy have all uncovered this. Basically, the perpetrators, the senior intelligence people concerned, have never been punished. And if you ask me why we've got problems now in the world, it's because those people have never been brought to book, and they need to be.
One of the ironies of that period to me is that certainly by the mid-1970s, the Italian Communist Party had more or less become a pretty moderate social democratic party under Berlinguer, who'd broken with Moscow publicly. One of the things I find strange is that actually at that time in the Cold War, if you'd really wanted to bring the Cold War to an earlier end, then probably the way to have done it would have been if the Italian Communist Party had come to power in Italy. It couldn't have done so alone. It would have probably been with radicals and Republicans and others in a coalition government. But, odd logic,
but I mean, don't forget that the powers that be have got their own agenda, which is to do with resources, imperialism, and all the rest of it. So they can't accept what to you and I would be a quite logical evolution of Western politics. Not in their book.
Well, on to our next story, and the children are back at school this week, as were the first edition of Prime Minister's Questions too. So let's have a listen to that.
You now see the Royal College of GPs, the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of Nurses, all supporting our health reforms. You even see Lord Darzai, the former health minister, supporting our health reforms. Labour have got themselves in a position of opposing all reform to the NHS and opposing the extra money into the NHS. That is their position.
Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, I think he's convinced the country he's on another planet from there. He's on another planet. I mean, he actually took time off his holiday, and he had his holidays interrupted. Fair play to him. But he took time off his holiday to tell the Western Morning News, and he just repeated it. What did he say? The whole health profession is now on board for what is being done. Mr. Speaker, I have to ask, does he read the newspapers? Because only on Tuesday of this week, the BMA, the Royal College of GPs, and the Royal College of Midwives all rejected his bill, and that was only this week. The truth is, Mr. Speaker, under this government, we are seeing two reckless and needless reorganisations of our public services. Yes. Police numbers down and waiting lists up. Yes. And under Labour, we saw police officers up and waiting lists down. Yes. Why doesn't he do the right thing for the future of our public services and scrap both of these disruptive and dangerous plans? Yes.
Isn't it interesting that he doesn't dare, in six questions, mention the economy? Yes.